Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMagan, senior editor for the Mises Institute's website, Mises.org. And I am here, as usual, with my associate editor, Tho Bishop. And we're both here today to talk a little bit about China. China, of course, frequently a topic of discussion for our readers in two contexts. One is the matter of the Chinese economy and how that will affect the international economic order and the dollar as reserve currency and so on. The other is China's geopolitical power, that is, how the Chinese state competes with the U.S. state. And specifically, we're going to look at the question of China's potential for outpacing the U.S. in terms of economic growth and geopolitical position. And we'll be drawing on a number of articles that have already appeared on Mises.org. But at the core of much of this is the narrative that the Chinese have figured out how to make socialism work somehow. That often the same people who talk in favor of free markets then turn around and say, well, socialism doesn't work in the rest of the world, but it seems to be working great in China. Clearly that's going to be a problem for us at the Mises Institute. That just doesn't make much sense. As Mihai Magovai noted in a recent article at Mises.org, he points out that China is just another heavily socialist economy with all the built-in potential for economic disaster, as we've seen over and over again in other command economies. And then there was an article by Joseph Solis Mullen, who pointed out Chinese resources are far more limited than people assume, and just one example of that being the fact that arable land per capita in China is equal to that of Saudi Arabia. They face a lot of constraints on even just feeding their population. And that translates into geopolitical power. As we see in a newish book by Michael Beckley, and I reviewed this for Mises.org, the book is titled Unrivaled: Why America Will Remain the World's Sole Superpower. Beckley notes China faces all sorts of problems, from geopolitics to demographics and to economic stagnation, debt being a significant problem. So let's get started. Tho, how are you?
Doing great, and excited to be back doing a Radio Rothbard podcast. And this is fun, as I think we're kind of paling back the editorial meetings a little bit, because I know you always want more foreign policy content. And so we're here to try to provide some of that with some of the foreign policy focus of the last month or so in the national political scene. So this is one of the fun topics, because I think both the mainstream narratives on both the left and the right get China as an issue very, very wrong. And that's exactly where we try to fill that void. So it's a fun topic.
And that's something we've been talking about behind the scenes for really a couple of years now. And I think some of it was prompted by the works of Alistair MacLeod, who does some really good content on gold and money and global trends in reserve currencies and that sort of thing. And he was one of the authors, I think, several years ago, who was looking a lot at their infrastructure efforts, their Belt and Road Initiative, their efforts to really get the world to move away from the dollar as the reserve currency. And this really just raised the question of, are they going to succeed at all of this? And do they have really what's necessary to do it? And should we be bullish on China from the Chinese state's perspective, right? I mean, being bullish on China in terms of it's a good place to invest, that's one thing. And actually, I don't think it's a great place to invest. But from Xi Jinping's perspective, should we be bullish on China? And there's a lot of reasons to not be so, that China's just got a lot of built-in problems. And let's just explore some of those really right now, because this is an important question, because it leads into a lot of other issues in terms of, does China pose a real threat to to U.S. monetary dominance? And that's a question that needs to be examined repeatedly. Keep going back to it and see where we are, because times change and situation changes. And is the dollar on the verge of collapse? I would say right now, no. And I certainly don't think that the yuan is about to replace it. Other issues are, if China is going to become this mega powerhouse, then that has foreign policy implications. But if China's restrained by dealing with its neighbors, by dealing with its internal population, by dealing with demographic problems, then that's a completely different foreign policy situation for the U.S. to look at. And of course, if you run columns on any of this stuff on the site and in social media, right, all sorts of people who of course use anonymous names and who knows what their background is. They're 14-year-old boys, for all I know. They've got very strong opinions about China. China's going to invade the U.S. next Tuesday, and you're just incredibly naive if you don't think they're going to. And, of course, our wonderful government's going to protect us from all of that. And it's amazing how confidently people proclaim these things, even against research like those done by Beckley, who writes a book, has hundreds of footnotes backing up these assertions. But that's all just garbage because I listened to some right-wing talk show host once about China, and he said China's really powerful. So it's clearly not a topic we can ignore. But I think what I started to see early on in terms of China and its limitations was the demographic issue. Now, people talk a lot about, oh, Japan is going to fall off a demographic cliff, and the U.S., even Americans aren't having enough babies. But not even Japan really is in the same league as China in terms of its demographic problems, thanks to China's one-child policy, which it ended in 2016 and is now on a three-child policy, which they introduced in May, I believe, of this year. But it hasn't made any difference. The Chinese birth rates just fell off a cliff after the one-child policy was introduced, of course. And even in recent years, their fertility's back at 1961 levels, which is when there was a famine. So they're just, their population's going nowhere. And as Beckley points out, and not just him, but lots of people have pointed out that China's main problem is it's going to get old before it gets rich. So Japan's already rich, so they can afford much more easily to get old. They've got lots of capital, lots of investment. They can manage immigration from Korea and so on to bring in workers when absolutely necessary. But China doesn't have those luxuries because China's not rich. China still has a GDP per capita that's really less than a third, well under a third of the U.S.'s. This is a developing country where 30% of farmers, where 30% of the population is still used for agriculture, which in the U.S. it's 1%. I mean, some very backward areas to the country. And so they need a large population of young productive workers. And it's not clear where they're going to get that at all in the next 20, 30 years. It's going to be a very ill, elderly and disabled population that's going to be dominated. And they're looking at really about one family, one working household per four retirees here in the not too distant future. So that's a huge burden on a country that's not wealthy. And you look at all that, and they're going to, if they're going to assert themselves globally, they're going to have to come up with some way to solve that problem.
No, absolutely. And this kind of plays into some of the other issues with, you know, the kind of the middle income trap, which is just something that we've seen historically, kind of the difficulty for developing countries, you know, once you have kind of taken advantage of, you know, so the theory goes, is that once you've taken advantage of your kind of competitive edge in terms of exporting goods that, you know, drives up wages, they actually, you know, changing from that to kind of a robust domestic economy. I mean, there's only so many countries that have done that throughout history. So, you know, on top of the consequences, again, of that, the one-child policy, again, it's very interesting to see that move from a ceiling to a floor in recent years. And also to kind of to the point, one of the things that I think makes this topic so interesting is that kind of the confusion on China comes from so many different spectrums of the political system, right? You have, I remember like back in like 2012, I don't know if you remember this commercial, Ryan, where it was like a right wing, I think it was maybe like a Koch brothers sort of Tea Party sort of apparatus. It had this commercial about how, you know, it was in a Chinese classroom and the professors talking about, oh, you know, what killed the Roman Empire, the American Empire, oh, it's dead. And, you know, they're all laughing because, you know, these smart, you know, smart China took advantage of the, all the spending that America has, which is a very big problem. But of course, one of the things, if you look about when you look at China, is that China's spending and its debt issues, particularly since the financial crisis, has grown exponentially. And so all of those concerns that we as Austrians identify here within the U.S. when it comes to, you know, extravagant policies from the Federal Reserve, when it comes to malinvestment in different sectors of the economy as a result, when it comes to cronyism, you know, all those issues that we see here at home, China has it on an even larger scale. And that's why you've seen, I think even like at one point, Peter Schiff was kind of making a big thing about how, oh, well, China's going to end up, you know, undercutting the dollar by like promoting a gold-backed currency. I'm not sure if himself pushed that, but there's been other commentators on that line. I even wrote an article about that in 2015 because I didn't know any better at the time. And of course, it doesn't really work if your debt is expanding at a much higher rate than your gold holdings are. And that's kind of one of the issues there. On the other side of it, though, is that you have, I remember it was Thomas Friedman, I think in 2009 or something like that, you know, he talked about like, oh, well, just golly gosh darn, just imagine what we could do if America was had a government like China for a day. And by that, they mean a government where, you know, it's you don't have all these pesky checks and balances that it stopped things from getting done. This is the peak of the Obama years. And like, oh, well, you know, we could solve the Great Recession. We could solve climate change. We could solve, I don't know, Michelle, but, you know, the childhood obesity. If only our government was as powerful as the CCP. And of course, you had to walk that back a little bit. But ultimately, I think this is kind of really the mindset that a lot of, you know, globalist institutions in general kind of take is that, oh, well, you know, democracy shouldn't get in the way of the plan. You know, there's this 5-year plan, 10-year plan, you know, these long, great leaps. And this is, of course, exactly what we've seen play out in China. And again, this kind of went against some of the expectation of the 90s, right? So, oh, well, you know, as China becomes a more liberal marketplace, trade is naturally going to bring Chinese government to a more liberal position. And this is kind of, you know, that has kind of been used. You've seen some like the national populist sort of Trump side kind of use this as a talking point, laughing at the advocates of free trade. I think it's probably improper to do so because China was kind of liberalizing, you know, gearing, you know, as it was getting wealthier. The issue came when Xi took over the country, you kind of saw this reversal of this liberal, you know, gradual liberalization of China. Of course, China itself, you know, culturally doesn't have that Western past, which has some influence here. We see this when we can look at other Asian countries like Singapore and Japan. And, you know, there's some differences there in cultural things that we can't just yada yada over. But under Xi, we've seen even further expansion of kind of the central planning of this debt, of this attempt to kind of control, regulate the market towards whatever Xi has decided as being the great plan of China. And so, you know, in the same way, I think we've seen political acceleration within the West in a variety of different ways this past decade. We've also seen that similar sort of, you know, neo-Maoist sort of acceleration with Xi, which kind of made headlines a few months ago with some of the celebrations for the 100th year anniversary of the CCP. And also kind of corresponding with some domestic issues like, concerns about, you know, where exactly is Jack Ma these days, you know, crackdowns on cultural production, you know, the against wealth and these sort of aspects that we've seen accelerate recently. And so, again, it's just one of these interesting areas where, again, I think fully appreciate China as a geopolitical threat, for lack of a better word, to America or the West or however you want to define things, without having a greater underlying appreciation for the instability of, you know, this, you know, modern form of, you know, when the CCP really controls capital markets here, you know, it's this modern form of capital, you know, state dictated capital. And so in much the same way that a lot of people in the late 80s, you had Paul Samuelson with his infamous textbook about how the USSR was going to overcome America and economic standing in the world. I think that without looking at the fundamentals here, again, really Austrian insights when it comes to, you know, credit expansion, not just money creation, when it comes to bureaucracy, when it comes to so many of these things that we understand being detrimental to the health and well-being of a people in a society and a nation, it's interesting that we can kind of just assume that China can kind of work themselves out of this. Because I think there is kind of a built-in bias society that Chinese leadership is smarter than ours. And again, when you see the buffoons that are, you know, in positions of power in the US and UK and Australia and elsewhere, I understand why we can kind of get to that assumption, but I think it's mistaken. And I think that, you know, it should kind of, you know, in a certain sense, we should be kind of comforted by our own acknowledged understandings of the weaknesses that come with centralized control. And of course, this is exactly what I think so much the Austrian school really is dedicated to.
I think those are two of the overriding myths here behind him, how the average American thinks about China, right? Is A, they somehow have found the way to make government control of the economy work, and B, that Chinese politicians are brilliant geniuses who engage only in long-term strategic thinking. Now, the whole long-term strategic thinking thing, that has deep, deep roots in Cold War paranoia. You can go back into old Soviet Cold War stuff, and you can find endless books written on how Soviet politicians were deep thinkers who thought only about the future, and they only had long-term economic goals, and they were planning way ahead while Americans were too busy watching TV and just wanting to buy stuff and wake up, America. Don't you understand how much better and smarter the average Soviet citizen is than the average American? Of course, what we eventually found out was that that's completely not true. The average Soviet citizen was extremely inefficient, had complete contempt for the government, and the Soviet economy was in shambles. And of course, a lot of the information that we knew about the Soviet Union was garbage produced by the CIA. And the CIA would go in and count up how many department stores the Soviets had and how many missiles they had. And then it just turned out that everything in the Soviet Union was of much lower quality, which, by the way, is very similar to the situation with China. Chinese products, including military materiel, are just tend to be much lower quality. What they might build for export can be of high quality, but what's generally used, what can be afforded within the country, is something else entirely. And you had Whitaker Chambers, who wrote a book called Witness back in those days, and he was all pessimistic about how the Soviets would take over because Western man did not possess the spiritual gifts necessary to deal with communism and so on. You can see a lot of similar feeling in a lot of stuff that's being written about China right now. And then, of course, the other myth going back is that economic one, right? That somehow the socialist planning problem, the problem of price systems, the problem of calculation, that doesn't apply for some reason in China. And so you get endless articles by conservatives who claim to be generally in favor of markets, if not terribly libertarian about it, but generally in other contexts, they'll write all day about how the free market works better and will make you wealthy. And if you raise taxes in America, that's going to destroy the economy. But in China, there's no connection between government control of the economy and the success of the economy. And so there's just this total breakdown in logic between the two. In China, socialism works. In America, it's a disaster. So which is it? And that just seems to be the common way that that it seems to be argued right about now. But if you get into some of the weeds here and you look at some of the people who actually study China, you find that they didn't fall for that notion. In fact, you can see some good articles by China experts. There was one in The Atlantic called China Isn't That Strategic. And it looks at China's demographic disaster, that they could have seen the whole single child policy and the disasters that would bring ahead of time. They chose not to because they were more concerned with short term economic problems. And then in the same way with just the party in general, there's an article at The Diplomat talking about this, about how this is a complete myth. This is just something people believe because Henry Kissinger once talked about how strategic thinking the Chinese are compared to America. Of course, I don't know, was Kissinger ever right about anything? This was his opinion, but if we look at the real data here, we can see that China is primarily concerned with propping up its own legitimacy by being able to point to short-term economic successes. They absolutely are not in the game of long-range planning and dealing with short-term disadvantage. And then just telling the public, well, just wait and see. Wait and see, public, and our long game will really come to fruition, and then we'll beat those Westerners. They don't do that at all. They're constantly in search of benchmarks and other little bits of evidence and factoids that they can point to show how their economy is just taking off. But what that really means is they've got all these short-term goals. They've got bad data that they tend to inflate. Look how many miles of highway we build. Look at these apartment blocks we built. And they use that all day in an attempt to legitimize their regime But it's really just a matter of government subsidy. And they've got huge overcapacity problems. They've got these gigantic factories, which are being utilized maybe one third in their total capacity, because they just poured money into this stuff. And there's no demand for a lot of what they could produce. And not to mention, of course, the environmental disasters that come from subsidizing so much unused construction and industry, and they're just pouring pollutants into the rivers. And as I noted in my book review, Beckley notes that breathing Beijing air is similar to smoking 40 cigarettes a day, and illness is a real problem because of the sheer level of pollution. This is all evidence of extreme short-term planning on the part of the Chinese regime, and they're real concerned with maintaining their power. It doesn't speak at all toward this idea that they're looking far into the future and are so much more brilliant than everybody else.
Right. I mean, this really is kind of perhaps like hyper Keynesianism. I know Per Bylund has written an article for the Institute, I think, calling China a Keynesian monster. It also kind of brings to mind, I think, it was the German Introduction to General Theory, where Keynes kind of talks about how there's something to be said about, you know, his ideas might have even more value in kind of a control sort of structure like Germany had relative to the laissez-faire traditions of the West. That kind of comes to mind here. I know one of the books that I've read that really kind of opened my eyes to the degree of the problems, and I think it's a really fascinating one for a reason I'm going to get to. It's called China's Great Wall of Debt by Denny McMahon. And one of the things I really like about it is that the author was a Wall Street Journal reporter from Australia. And the book reads just like him describing what's going on. He has no theoretical sort of lens that he's applying. He's just describing what he saw from after the end of the financial crisis to 2018, which is when the book came out. And, you know, at one point he talks about the skyscraper curse, and he talks about, like, oh, no one knows exactly why the skyscraper curse was. He clearly hasn't read his Mark Thornton. That's okay. But it's interesting, though, because it provides all these very interesting illustrations very vividly, and then we can have, you know, and again, as an Austrian reading it, it all makes so much sense. And one of the aspects of it, again, like the aspect of debt in the Chinese economy, when we think about, like, one of the things that's very interesting about the way that the Chinese economy system is structured is that, you know, the locales and kind of, you know, the local governments, they don't issue debt and municipal bonds kind of the same way the tradition, you know, that's not the main, you know, that's how they, or even with taxes, the main funding source for these regions are these state-backed enterprises. And so in these state-backed enterprises, of course, they're going back to what you mentioned earlier about the short-term sort of aspects of so much Chinese policy. You know, they're thinking about employment numbers, right? You know, they're thinking about the short, you know, measurements that they can then go and tell the higher up, you know, because I'm doing my quota. Of course, then that gets to a secondary issue, which just goes to the accuracy of that data going upward. I know one of the problems you had during like the early days of COVID, for example, is, you know, and you're in China and you have bad news to say. People don't like to hear bad news, which is why they're arresting like the early doctors warning about this. So ignoring the questions of the accuracy of the data, you know, that is what they're trying to sell upwards. And so you end up with these situations where a lot of the traditional loans and a lot of the traditional financial sector of the Chinese economy is to these state-backed enterprises. And, you know, when we think about, you know, because the mispricing of risk, when we think about the way that these debt assets are then used within, I mean, China's economy is a lot more controlled than say the U.S. one per se, you know, but still the way that that debt is held on to as products and things like that. If, you know, if America, for example, 2007, if the percentage of like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who are similar government-backed enterprises, they were engaging in loans based off of political calculations more than market, you know, numbers, similar sort of, you know, dynamic. I'm not going to quite say, you know, some significant difference between them, but still works. If that same size of the economy happened in 07, I mean, like the financial crisis, they would have been much, much larger, because then you have all this debt that there's just no way of properly figuring out exactly what's in here. Because again, this politicalization, and again, like it's, you know, these aspects, again, we as Austrians, if Austrian theory has any validity to the real world, you know, when you recognize the consequences of this arbitrary, this politicized expansion of credit not backed by underlying assets, and that highlights, I think, how much of this is a problem. And it's funny because, you know, some of these things like the ghost cities, defenders of the Chinese regime will point to those and saying, oh, well, this is exactly, see how forward thinking they are. They're building entire cities before they need it. And again, as we just mentioned, populations may not be there for them to need that growth in the future. But too, like they're not seeing that these are clearly make work projects. And then actually, if you look down, drive even deeper on like the behavior of a lot of Chinese residents, a lot of people, rather than saving in the traditional banking system like they have in the past, this was always, again, one of those other sort of counter arguments in favor of China. So, oh, look, the Chinese savings rate relative to the decadent Westerner, you know, they just have a lot, you know, they think for the future a lot more, right? Well, after 08, the same way as the rest of the world, you have that low interest rate environment. You know, you don't have traditional bank accounts, you know, being used as wealth building assets. You know, that pushed a lot of Chinese citizens into owning, a speculative house that you could sell in the future, into shadow banking markets in the way that those can have far better payouts with perhaps some additional risk involved. And so again, like it's these, even the things that people will point to and say, see, that's China thinking ahead. If you look a little deeper, I think you'll see that just like everywhere else, the political motivations tend to trump sound analysis. And again, it's as true in Beijing as it is in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, building an apartment block that's going to sit 90% empty for years. That's great planning. Perfect. Good idea. But people will point to that, as you say, and say, hey, look, everything's ready to go. Look at all this. Look at all this capital they have. Look at all this capacity they got. That's not an official use of resources. As you say, I think on the whole issue of how economic resources are used in general, especially in terms of debt, pretty much anything you can say about the U.S., you can say even more so about China, right? In terms of the creation of money and credit. In terms of debt levels, China now matches the U.S. in terms of its debt to GDP ratio, except that China's is growing at a faster pace and certainly growing faster than any other developing countries. Because, and keep in mind, they're not rich yet. Also, as they take on all this debt, they're paying higher interest rates for it. So it's a higher drain on their economy overall. They don't have the benefits of their currency being a reserve currency, and they're not really headed in that direction either. And we can look at also bad loans. In fact, I was just looking at some of the business press from East Asia, and they actually use the word contagion to talk about the problem of bad loans in China right now. That's a word I haven't seen in several years. And so if that's actually being brought up as a real fear in China, that's a significant problem. Of course, contagion could happen here at any time. But again, China's starting from a much lower standard of living. They don't have the ability to keep on borrowing as much as the U.S. could, and they're already looking at much higher interest rates. So all of these issues are significant for them and don't point toward an easy transition to wealth. But I think a lot of this just comes back to the issue of convergence theory, which people may not even be familiar with that phrase, but I think a lot of Americans believe it, which is this idea that developing countries develop at faster rates than rich countries. And that's not really necessarily the case. It's absolutely true that some poor countries are growing faster and are moving toward catching up very, very slowly with the West. But that doesn't really happen that much. In fact, you could look at, say, the fact that East Germany is still the poorest part of Germany to this day. Just a few decades of Soviet rule has rendered East Germany far behind the rest of the country, even after 30 years of the West Germans pouring money into East Germany in an attempt to bring them up to West German standards, still not there. And if you look at the last 200 years, rich countries generally grow faster than poor countries. And poor countries also are often poor because they have bad protections for private property and so on. There tends to be a greater risk of government expropriation. And so those countries often have a tendency of slipping back into their old ways and then experiencing economic decline. Venezuela, which once was one of the richest countries in Latin America, has gone into decline now, has gone into reverse. Because they just didn't have the institutional inertia to prevent that sort of thing from happening. And there's certainly no reason why that's impossible in China. So there's no reason to assume that just because China is a developing country that it's going to soon be catching up. It's actually pretty rare for a country that's that's way behind to catch up with the wealthy countries. Now, it might get rich, but it's unlikely to get as rich as the rich countries, because even though those countries might be growing fast, rich countries continue to grow. It's not like they just stop. And so you got to grow really fast for a really long time to get as rich as a rich country if you're a developing country now. So this is the reality for a lot of developing countries. But I do think a lot of people just believe that the developing world it's in the process of becoming like Switzerland. And that's just not something we're going to see in our lifetimes.
And to be fair, the people that make this mistake, it's not simply John Q. Public, you know, that just this, you know, just kind of has this gut, you know, rejection of the foreign, or you kind of has, you know, plays with these kind of civilizational clash, you know, fantasies and you know that they're concerned about. You know, it's major Wall Street institutions, it's major businesses in general. Not you know, you see with you know, sports leagues have increasingly dictated a lot of their focus on that, particularly with the NBA. You know, they're putting a lot of their eggs in the long-term basket of appealing to a Chinese audience, since the American audience has kind of turned away from them. That's kind of a fun conversation itself. And then I think what's important to understand there is that, you know, a lot of people, you know, again, it's this, there is this baked in expectation that, oh, well, the Chinese domestic market, that China's going to, you know, the wage rates are going to continue to increase. The purchasing power of your average Chinese citizen is going to massively increase. If we see this massive increase happens amongst everyone within China, you're then going to have the creation of this domestic marketplace that is so attractive that if you simply sell one square inch of fabric to every Chinese consumer, then all of a sudden you're going to be, you know, the richest person in the world, right? And so there's this greed, I think, you know, it's a lack of a better word. I mean, this, you know, poorly thought out greed, looking at what is possible there, that is directing a lot of these companies there, mixed with the fact that, again, you know, it's not that China, you know, again, we should also be very clear about what China is doing and the way that they wield their economic policies for sort of, they would say national advantage, I would say party advantage. And again, this, I think, is why some people, you know, even on the right, kind of look at China and see an example that there's some lessons to learn for, because it's the idea that, oh, well, they're doing things for the national good. The problem is they're really not, because ultimately the consequences of all of this is, you know, again, they have built up, you know, when you end up having that marketplace, you know, be so dependent upon debt rather than the actual production of goods and services and in long-term capital goods that are necessary. You know, so long as, you know, there's so much of their resources being dedicated towards mining out copper, oil, or ore, then goes set that since sits for years in warehouses throughout China not being used. This is draining the nation of these resources. It is trying to prop things up using the printing press and bank standards to try to make the public not feel as poor, make them feel better off than they are. It plays out when it actually plays out and hits the consumer, it's usually dealing with foreign goods. For example, in 2019, you had a series of bank failures there before COVID came out, which is very interesting. But one of the struggles there was that you had double digit pork price inflation going on, because America was a large producer of Chinese of the pork that Chinese consumes. China consumes more pork than anywhere else. You know, they had a swine flu epidemic there too. So you had a supply shock combined with this, and they weren't bringing in American swine because of the Trump trade deals, all this sort of stuff. And all of a sudden, you know, China can, you know, the yuan doesn't leave China, so China can do a lot of stuff. With, you know, I think in one of those great myths is that, you know, everyone's convinced that, oh, China's artificially keeping the yuan, you know, down to benefit exports and weaponizing that against the West. I think probably more accurately, that their concern is about massive inflation after the past decade. But they can control sort of, you know, they can replace yuan debt with more yuan. It is when they have to deal with foreign reserves that, you know, leave the country. Like, that's where, you know, where you end up seeing a lot of stresses going forward. And so, again, when we're seeing this period of rising corporate, you know, that leads to the other side as well, because you do have, you know, Western financial institutions that have exposure to the Chinese debt. You know, when you're starting to see waves of Chinese corporations, you know, having problems paying their debt, the consequences that can have in international markets is something interesting beyond simply China's own problems. And so, again, that's one of these things where China can do, and in spite of everything we're seeing here about the weaknesses within the Chinese economy, and the misperceptions about their power, you know, China can also still do a lot of harm to the global economy, not simply as a product of, you know, the international aspects of bad, you know, debt offerings, but also just, you know, the dangers that come with a desperate state trying to, you know, maintain control of its population. And of course, you know, that leads to, you know, we could think about all of the different innovations that the CCP has found for increasing its surveillance and control of the nation. It's interesting the degree of Western countries that have adopted some of those methods in the past 18 months. But, you know, it's not that we should take China lightly in terms of, you know, outward consequence potential from issues here. It's just that they are not, again, anyone trying to sell you that China could be, you know, the bipolar rival of the U.S. and is making a lot of the same mistakes that we saw in the 1980s with the USSR.
Well, and I think in the final section of this, we could look at just what is the military analysis of all of this. So we've been talking mostly about how China's resources are very limited. It's not headed toward being an economic or a demographic powerhouse. And those are very important in terms of military resources available. A sick elderly population is not great for projecting power, and the U.S. does not have that problem. The U.S. is going to remain a much younger, more productive country, thanks partly to immigration, and there's not much immigration into China for what should be obvious reasons. But the U.S. Certainly has a younger population with higher fertility still, and will continue to do that. And not to mention just all the resources it has available and all the capital accumulation that's taken place over the last 200 years. But how does that translate into military power? And we can look at just the realities here in terms of the quality of military materiel that China has. And Beckley looks at this in a lot of detail. First of all, in terms of just having the resources necessary to feed and clothe troops, yes, Chinese troops are a lot cheaper, but the quality of the equipment they have, and that's why they're cheaper, is they're given less equipment, they're given, they don't have the body armor resources, they don't have as quality housing, they don't have nearly as much training, they don't do as nearly as many exercises. And for example, then just keeping them fed would be a major problem during wartime, because China is a net grain importer and depends heavily on the United States for a lot of its agricultural products. So that's a strategic problem right there for them. But in terms of submarine warfare, Beckley goes into a fair amount of detail on this. Chinese submarines are no match for the U.S. They're diesel powered. They're nothing like U.S. Either tactical or strategic submarines. And this would be a key issue in case China attempted to project its power, say, into Taiwan or in China. The Strait of Taiwan would become a big problem for China under those conditions. Beckley also looks into a lot of detail about the Taiwan situation and how easily could it invade Taiwan. And he notes that attempting amphibious assaults are extremely problematic. Amassing your troops nowadays just makes your troops a sitting duck. So you put 10,000 troops in one place and decide to land them somewhere with precision-guided missiles, which Taiwan has lots and lots of. That just means you're putting people there that can be incinerated within a few minutes. And I think that's part of what many Americans still think in terms of why China is so powerful, is China has a lot of people, and China can just throw 100,000 troops at a some sort of U.S. military installation, let's say. But the reality is that it's just throwing troops at a problem. It's not 1925. It's with the sort of modern weaponry that the U.S. has, you can have a large number of troops, and it does not change the balance. In many, many situations. And then we just look at the quality of naval material that the U.S. has versus China. Counting up boats isn't enough. That's the old method of counting up the Soviet economy, just saying China has X number of boats, and that's more than the U.S. has. that's really not sufficient analysis to give us an idea of what the real military prowess is. And then another important issue here is not we're just assuming some sort of head-on U.S.-China conflict in these cases, but as Beckley's careful to note, China has the world's longest land border. It has 14 neighbors that it has to deal with. Those are just the land borders. It, of course, is hemmed in by Taiwan, which is rapidly becoming a closer ally of Japan in spite of their bad history. And Japan has for decades seen China as a strategic problem and has been devoting more resources to that. And of course, Japan's light years ahead of China in terms of technology and in its military resources. And so, and Vietnam is has had small shooting conflicts with China in recent decades. There's Malaysia, which is in conflict with China over the South China Sea. There is, of course, the South Koreans who are not fans of China. There are all these problems that China faces geopolitically that the U.S. simply doesn't have any problems with. The U.S. has two neighbors, neither of which have pose any serious problem for the U.S. And that just goes to show what sort of resources would be available to China in case of a real conflict. And of course, its neighbors would attempt to use the situation of a war with the U.S. to forward their own interests against China. And a lot of those countries have military resources that are about up to speed with what China has. And so that's a real problem for China. And then not to mention, this has been made in a few places. The Jamestown Foundation has some research on this from a few years ago, noting that internal conflict in China has increased substantially. That think of all their ethnic minorities like the Uyghurs and the Tibetans and other smaller minority groups. And then even just within its Han ethnic majority, continued problems in terms of lower level dissidence that's taking place within the country. And this can be noted that even the Chinese government admits that incidents and domestic security spending. So this is like homeland security stuff, the sort of stuff that we would spend on like internal terrorism and that sort of thing has increased tenfold in the last decade or so in China. So that's a lot of spending that they have to devote to border control, to dealing with their neighbors. The Indian border is a big problem. And the U.S. simply doesn't have those concerns when it comes to actual defense.
Of course, I mean, one of those, you know, border conflicts that, you know, has been a pretty interesting the last and in recent history is with India, which is kind of one of those nations with the same, you know, a large population, you know, a lot of you know, high projection about, you know, the economic growth in that country. So no, it's always easy to oversimplify, you know, the idea of, you know, playing, you know, army men, you know, abstract from, you know, the realities of the world we're living in. And of course, I think this is something that, you know, we're going to do a few episodes with foreign policy in mind, because it's one of those issues where, you know, within the libertarian sphere, you know, simply responding to this stuff with the proper moral reaction, you know, say a moral repulsion to war and murder writ large. You know, some of these conversations when it comes to strategy and it comes to the realities of international affairs and you know, the interactions of governing institutions, you know, it requires a deeper understanding than just that natural rejection. And, you know, diving deeper into some of these very real conflicts, and you know, I'm looking forward to several of these episodes coming out much quicker than our last one, to kind of dive into some of these issues more.
Well, on that note, we better wrap up our episode for today, and I thank everyone for listening. And it's good to talk to you again, Tho. It has been too long, yeah, hopefully this won't become a quarterly podcast. Maybe I hear that some people do podcasts every single week, and maybe that's something to aspire to. We shall see.
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever get to the old Wood standard of a podcast every
daily
day,
yes. I don't see that. I don't think that's in since I'm such a Chinese like long-term strategic thinker, I'm just going to admit that that's not in the cards for now. But for now, I thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.